This changed everything. Fremont was now taking the long way around, north along his supply lines and then east, pushing his army up the South Branch Valley to Moorefield, where he would take a right turn and head to Strasburg to cut Jackson off. Lincoln, understanding nothing of Fremont's problems, was furious when he found out. "I see that you are at Moorefield," he wired Fremont angrily. "You were expressly ordered to march to Harrisonburg. What does this mean?" But there was nothing he could do. Lincoln ordered Fremont and his army to occupy Strasburg by the evening of May 30, which would put his 15,000 men there well ahead of Jackson. But here once again fate took a hand. Because of heavy rains and bad roads, and Fremont's rather obvious inability to move an army as Stonewall Jackson could, Fremont had to camp that night 20 miles west of Strasburg, at Wardensville. He would not be able to reach Strasburg until the 31st. Union Brigadier General James Shields, meanwhile, back in the valley now and looking for payback, though not quite so blustery as before, also was poised to reach Strasburg on that same day. Meaning that in spite of the delays, the jaws of Lincoln's marvelous trap were finally in position to snap closed, and just in time, too. It was also that very same day, May 31, that Jackson, with his main column, infantry, artillery, wagons, and 2,300 Union prisoners, dragged themselves out of their camps north of Winchester in a heavy downpour. They had more than 20 miles to go. An objective observer would have said they had no chance. All of this set up one of the most stirring foot races in military history, a perilous gauntlet run that few believed Jackson could possibly win. Citizens of Winchester gazed with fading hope upon their shabbily dressed, somber-faced general as he rode out of town and tried to convince themselves that things were not as bad as they seemed. We left our friends in Winchester trembling for our fate, and more than we trembled ourselves, wrote Kid Douglas. Everybody felt the great danger. But everybody looked at old Jack, and seeing him calm and cool as if nothing was the matter, they came to the conclusion that their destruction could not be as inevitable as they supposed. Jackson pushed his foot cavalry hard that day, though perhaps for once they did not need to be pushed. Every man understood the peril he was in and knew that speed was his only hope. They knew, too, that strung out in a ponderous 15-mile-long column on the valley pike, they were exceptionally vulnerable to flank attacks from the two Union armies that had been sent to destroy them. Rumors swept through the ranks that Union forces had already occupied Strasburg, that they were already cut off, that Banks and Brigadier General Rufus Sexton were marching in their rear with a combined force as large as their own. The army itself, in its entirety, was at risk. One need only exchange Union for Confederate commanders to see what might have happened to it. Jackson would have cut such an army to pieces on the road. Nothing of the sort happened. That afternoon, the entire unwieldy train made it safely, to many of the men miraculously, into bivouac just north of Strasburg. They had run the gauntlet unharmed. Jackson had won the critical leg of the race. There were no Union troops in sight. In Boteler's description, Jackson was standing there like a hunted stag at bay, defying his pursuers. Though his own soldiers did not yet understand why or to what magic they owed their deliverance, they gratefully made their camps in the rain. But now, ironically, it was Jackson who was really worried. This was because the Stonewall Brigade under Charles S. Winder and the 1st Maryland Regiment, Confederate, which had trailed the main army from Harper's Ferry, had not quite reached Strasburg. It was not for want of trying. They had marched 35 miles or more that day without food. They had finally collapsed late in the evening at Newtown, 10 miles north of Strasburg, where many of them simply fell down and slept in the muddy fields. Jackson now knew that he had not only to hold his own position the next day against the two Union armies, he also had to hold the valley pike open for Winder and his cherished brigade. He would need another miracle. But how exactly had he escaped? The answer had more to do with the character and sensibility of his opponents than with strictly military strategy. The one who had the clearest shot at him was James Shields, the Irish-born politician who had been promoted to Major General after the Battle of Kernstown, who had once bragged that Jackson was afraid of him, and who only days before had vowed confidently that he would soon clear out the Shenandoah Valley. Shields' main problem now was, in fact, fear. His own, of Jackson's growing legend, which was beginning to disconcert otherwise rational men. It was dressed up in different ways and rationalized in different ways, but it came down to the same thing. The fear began with basic assumptions about Jackson's army. Though Jackson still had merely 15,000 men at his disposal, and the Union War Department believed this, in the eyes of its field generals, Jackson's strength had grown enormously. A close reading of Union dispatches shows various Union scouts estimating Jackson's strength the day before at 30,000 to 60,000. That same day, General Geary put the number at 25,000 to 30,000. McDowell himself accepted the 30,000 figure. On the day Jackson slid through, Shields himself was reporting Jackson at Winchester with as many as 40,000 troops. Shields believed the higher numbers because he wanted to, and believing them, found his own 11,000, unreinforced as yet by the other 9,000 of McDowell's troops, to be inadequate. Then, too, he saw phantoms. He got the ridiculous idea that Confederate James Longstreet was moving up the Luray Valley with an army. Ridiculous, because that would have left virtually no Confederate troops to defend Richmond. He also became convinced that Turner Ashby's small cavalry, which Jackson had deployed on the road near Front Royal, was actually a large and formidable force. He did not have, moreover, specific orders from McDowell to attack, even though he knew as well as anyone that the whole idea, and the thing Lincoln wanted more than anything in the world, was to cut off Jackson's retreat. So Shields, tying himself in mental knots at his camp in Front Royal, did nothing at all. It was not until early evening that he finally got up the small amount of courage required to test the enemy's strength by sending a regiment against Ashby. The rebels were almost instantly routed. He had been afraid of nothing. But by now, Jackson's army was in Strasburg, and it was too late to do anything about it. Shields, meanwhile, saved his most creative excuse for last. 2 days later, he wired the War Department to say that his decision to stay put had been quite deliberate and calculated. "We would have occupied Strasburg," he wrote, "but dare not interfere with what was designed for Fremont. His failure has saved Jackson." Having shifted the blame to Fremont, he added, breathtakingly, that he was off to chase Jackson, "and I have no fears of their numbers, which have been ridiculously exaggerated by fear." Was Fremont really to blame? He was to blame in the larger sense that in spite of constant goading from Washington, he had failed to bring up his army in time to cut Jackson off. He had arrived late on the afternoon of May 31 in camps about 5 miles east of Strasburg. He had been in no mood to push his men further. Like Shields, he could list any number of excuses and reasons for his lateness. The men were exhausted from brutal marches in bone-drenching rains and knee-deep muck. They were sick, disabled, broken down, hungry from want of rations. Straggling had reduced the size of his army. They were indeed demoralized, and had been since their muddy camps in Franklin. There was something of the loser about Fremont, something that suggested only bleakness and indecision and hardship and misery, and none of the glory and clarity that soldiers craved. They reacted by giving him glum half-efforts, by straggling and complaining. Jackson had faced the same conditions, the same scanty supplies, the same numbers of barefoot, sick, waterlogged troops. His desertion rates were far worse. Considering Lincoln's sharp, almost scolding tone in his dispatches to Fremont, and his constant exhortations to move faster, it is astonishing that the Pathfinder elected to give his men a full day of rest on May 29, a mere 20 miles from Strasburg. Shields was wrong. Both he and Fremont had failed together. And thus, together, they had saved Jackson. The next day was, if anything, more dramatic than the last. A snapshot of troop deployments on the morning of June 1 would have found Jackson camped just north of Strasburg, Shields 12 miles east in Front Royal, Fremont 5 miles to the west, and Winder 10 miles north on the Valley Pike. The latter was soon barreling south toward safety, fearful that he was too late. Jackson had decided that he would wait for Winder and his roughly 2,000 men. He had erred in allowing his command to become so badly separated. Now he would fight, if necessary, to reunite it. He would fight both armies if he had to. His instincts, which would prove correct, told him that he would not. In a sign of extreme disrespect for Shields, he sent no infantry at all in his direction, but once again merely fanned Ashby's cavalry out on the road from Front Royal to Winchester. Ashby's pickets would tell him if Shields made a move to cut off Winder. Jackson, meanwhile, threw the hard-fighting Ewell and his division out to the west, where they formed a line of battle and waited for Fremont, fully ready to fight. Just before 10 a.m., Fremont's big guns thundered, Ewell's replied, and an artillery duel sent booming echoes through the hills. North of town, the men of the Stonewall Brigade, hurtling southward, took it as a bad omen. They were already too late. But Fremont, as it turned out, was making only the most cursory of probes. When Ewell sent skirmishers bristling forth, and the crack of muskets rolled through the valley, Union troops withdrew to their lines. The artillery still thundered, but to no particular effect. To Ewell's surprise, there was no push. While Ewell held Fremont at bay, the first of Winder's units hove into view. It was an emotional moment. We could plainly see the smoke of the discharges of the guns we had heard, and we knew that Jackson was holding back Fremont till we got by, wrote McHenry Howard of the 1st Maryland, Confederate, in a later memoir. To our relief, everything continued quiet on the Front Royal side, where we looked for trouble from an advance by Shields or McDowell. At noon, the Stonewall Brigade arrived in Strasburg, a bit shaken by the stress of the morning march and by having walked 45 miles in 2 days with no food. An astonishing feat of marching that shamed Fremont's army and seemed to confirm what at least one Federal officer believed, that Stonewall Jackson's men will follow him to the devil, and he knows it. The men were ecstatic to be reunited with the army, though they were not yet out of harm's way. It had been a harrowing last few miles. How different our feelings then, wrote Private Randolph H. McKim of the 1st Maryland Confederate. Our spirits rose and we forgot our fatigue and were ready to sing, "Baltimore Ain't We Happy." What the men said to each other then was of a different complexion. "Old Jack knows what he's about. He'll take care of us, you bet." From that hour, we never doubted him. Fremont, who had his command ready for battle by late morning, was simply frozen by uncertainty and fear. That Jackson outnumbered him, that he would have to fight Jackson without McDowell's help. With an army about the size of Jackson's, he was cowed into inaction, even though his friends in Washington had told him, in no uncertain terms, that he must find Jackson and fight him, or his chances thereafter for further preferment or reputation were as naught. Apparently that wasn't motivation enough. With his army now reunited, Jackson pulled out of Strasburg and once again, this was starting to look bizarrely familiar, headed south on the Valley Pike. This time he had two armies to worry about. But anyone with a memory for recent history would also have known that Stonewall Jackson in flight up the Shenandoah Valley was a prelude to large, unanticipated, war-changing events. Chapter 30. A Strange Fondness for Traps. By early June, it could be fairly said that Jackson had done everything Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee had asked him to do, and more. For 2.5 months, he and his small, highly mobile force had occupied the attention of ever larger Union armies. He had managed, by the sheer weight of his daring and audacity, and a growing reputation for both, to create a diversion that had temporarily stalled the Union campaign in front of Richmond. He had even thrown the northern capital into a brief fit of panic. Now, having narrowly slipped through Lincoln's pincers, the last thing anyone expected him to do was to turn and fight. He did not need to. His escape over the Blue Ridge to the safety of Robert E. Lee's army was guaranteed. But escape had never figured in his plans. On June 5, Jackson, having sent his trains of captured supplies and sick and wounded men south to Stanton, turned off the Valley Pike at Harrisonburg, marched a few miles south and east on a narrow, rutted clay road, and under the looming 2,900-foot southern tip of the Massanutten Mountain, bivouacked his army in rolling farmland near an obscure River Junction hamlet called Port Republic, and spun around to face his pursuers. This time they were coming at him from two different directions. To understand the nature of the threat, we have to back up several days to a time when Jackson was still retreating southward. After Shields had failed to intercept Jackson at Strasburg, the pugnacious Irishman had conceived what seemed to him a brilliant idea. While Fremont pursued Jackson in the now familiar way, straight down the Valley Pike, Shields would reverse Jackson's stunning juke-step march against Front Royal. The Union general would start from his camps in that town, then slide southward along the South Fork of the Shenandoah, cross the Massanutten at New Market, and block Jackson's southward retreat. Though he began his march down the boggy roads on the east side of the massive mountain, in yet another of the seemingly eternal rainstorms that swept Virginia that spring, he was more confident than ever that this time he would bag the rebel Jackson. If the previous engagements with Jackson were about speed and maneuver, this one, featuring three armies instead of two, would be more like an intricate game of martial chess, played out among the roaring rivers, ravines, spurs, and ridges of the Luray and Shenandoah Valleys. The game this time was mostly about bridges, four of them, strung out over roughly 40 miles in the Luray Valley between the towns of Luray and Port Republic. They were important because the South Fork of the Shenandoah, a navigable river in normal times that carried flatboats downstream to Harper's Ferry, was in flood stage, swift, swollen, and unfordable. Shields realized that he desperately needed the northernmost of those bridges, named White House and Columbia, to cross the river, cut through New Market Gap, and intercept Jackson in the Shenandoah Valley. On June 1, while Jackson was still passing through the jaws of Lincoln's trap, Shields had dispatched one of his best officers, Colonel Samuel S. Carroll, to travel ahead of the army to seize and hold those bridges. He had other work for Carroll, too. 10 miles south was another bridge at the hamlet of Conrad Store, over which Jackson and his army had passed when retreating from Banks in April. It was the most direct escape route from the Mid-Valley to the Blue Ridge Mountains. Shields, convinced that Jackson was indeed trying to escape, ordered Carroll to burn the Conrad Store Bridge. "Everything depends on speed," Shields told him. "Jackson must be overtaken." And then, underscoring how vastly important this assignment was, he promised the young officer a brigadier generalship if he succeeded. "You will earn your star," he said, "if you do all this." It was a good idea. Unfortunately for Shields, Jackson had beaten him to it. Jackson had noticed that Shields had not joined Fremont in pursuit of him, and had guessed correctly that the Union general was taking the back way through the Luray Valley to cut him off. Jackson had immediately dispatched Samuel Coiner of Ashby's cavalry, who rode down the Valley Pike, crossed the mountain at New Market, and at dawn on June 2, after struggling through deep mud, a driving thunderstorm, and the roughest road, managed to burn both the Columbia and White House bridges. Carroll's men, on foot and saddled with four pieces of artillery Shields had ordered them to carry, were 2 days behind them. Curiously, Coiner and his Confederates had exactly the same orders Carroll did for the bridge at Conrad's Store. Destroy it. Coiner, of course, beat Carroll again, and burned it the next day. But how could it be in both generals' interests to burn the same bridge? Because once again, Shields had grossly misread his opponent. Instead of fleeing to Stannardsville on the eastern side of the Blue Ridge, Jackson was doing the thing Shields least expected him to do, which was to stand and fight. And because he had chosen to stay put, the very last thing he wanted was for the two Union armies to be able to easily unite against him. Burning the Conrad Store Bridge and the two bridges near New Market Gap meant that would never happen. Jackson had decisively won the opening gambit. As the badly bogged-down Shields would soon discover, he could neither cut off Jackson's retreat nor unite easily with Fremont. Thus, three of the bridges. The fourth and most critical to Jackson's strategy was in the town of Port Republic, a small cluster of buildings in the delta formed by the North River and the South River just before they flowed together to form the South Fork of the Shenandoah. Shields, increasingly lost in his own private fog of war, would misunderstand its importance too. Jackson had chosen Port Republic over every other place he could have gone, and by now he and his brilliant cartographer, Jed Hotchkiss, knew all of them, because of its peculiar location at the junction of the three rivers. His army, on the morning of Sunday, June 8, was camped in the rolling wheat fields north of the town, facing attack from Fremont's army from the direction of Harrisonburg, and from Shields coming down the Luray Valley. The Union armies were so close that they posed a classic problem of military strategy. Jackson could not afford to throw his entire army at one or the other. He could not take them in succession or in detail. He would somehow have to deal with both at once. It was yet another reason for him to march for Brown's Gap as fast as he could, depart the valley, and join the Confederate forces at Richmond. It is hard to think of another general, on either side, who at this point in the war would not have done so. But Port Republic, like so many of Jackson's choices of positions in the war, then and later, was actually a terrific tactical play. Its beauty lay in the fact that it offered both the protection of a roaring river and an escape hatch if things went wrong. Its best feature, tactically speaking, was a sturdy covered bridge over the rampaging North River. This was the fourth bridge. In the absence of the others, it was the only way for either army to cross the river. If Fremont beat him on the battlefield, he could easily retreat over the North River and burn the bridge. East of town there was the South River, breast high and moving like a mill race, but still fordable or bridgeable with pontoons or wagons. It separated him from Shields's oncoming army. If he lost that fight, he could recross the lesser stream and head to Brown's Gap a few miles away on a good road that ran south out of town. On the morning of June 8, Jackson's army looked like this. Its headquarters was in the small village of Port Republic. 7,000 men under his direct command were camped outside of town just north of the North River, while Ewell's 5,000-man force was camped about 4 miles north at a hamlet known as Cross Keys. Jackson's numbers were down because his brutal marches had once again taken a fearsome toll on his army, which now had at least 3,000 absentees. "We've been on a retreat for 5 days, and an awful time it has been," wrote one artillerist. "I never saw so many men with their feet all swollen and bleeding." Facing Ewell across gently swelling farmland covered by wheat, clover, patches of timber, and the occasional picturesque farmhouse were 12,000 bluecoats under Fremont in full battle lines and ready for a fight. To the east, bogged down in muck and mire downstream near Conrad's store, lurked Shields' brigades. For all of his cleverness in isolating his enemies and in devising a place where he might fight both of them, Jackson now made several critical errors in judgment. Having chosen this river straddle as his main tactical play, he proceeded to neglect the key to it all, the North River Bridge. Though that bridge needed no protection from north of Port Republic, where most of Jackson's army was bivouacked, it was deeply vulnerable from the south and east. But Jackson had placed only a very light guard on the two river fords across the South River, over which the threat from the east would come. There were no guards on the bridge itself. He made an even more serious mistake by ordering Quartermaster John Harmon's enormous wagon train, with most of the army's supplies, to park in the fields behind headquarters, both highly visible and highly vulnerable to any attack from the east. An advance unit from Shields had only to cross the fordable South River to get at them. Worse still, loss of the North Bridge would mean that Jackson's army and its supplies were on opposite sides of the unfordable river. Indeed, Jackson himself might have been separated from his own army. What had happened to cloud Jackson's mind? His staff was convinced that he was a victim of complete physical exhaustion. He was at least as tired as his men, many of whom had simply dropped by the roadside. He was often up at what he euphemistically called early dawn, what we would call the middle of the night, working on the endless details of command, many of which he insisted on keeping track of himself. Colonel Samuel Fulkerson wrote that his commander is remarkable for his energy and industry and sleeps very little, often while near the enemy. And while everybody except the guards are asleep, he's on his horse and gone, nobody knows where. He thus took the fate of the entire army on his shoulders, its life and death, its hard marches, and whatever food and clothing he could secure to keep it going. All of this cost him rest. There is little evidence that he had had a single full night's sleep since the Valley campaign began. On many nights, the wet weather precluded sleep at all. On June 4, Jackson's tent was the victim of a small flash flood in the middle of the night that carried away his hat and boots. He tried to sleep anyway, even though the tent was still full of water. The next morning, according to Douglas, it was still full of various small articles of apparel and furniture floating about like little boats. Such was life on the march that spring. Jackson was so weary that he sometimes fell asleep fully clothed, even wearing his sword and boots. Sandy Pendleton, who was probably closer to his commander than any of his aides, thought that in the first week of June, General Jackson was completely broken down. The consequences of Jackson's strange lassitude were not long in coming. At about 8:30 a.m., on the dry, mild morning of June 8, approximately 150 cavalry with four guns, under the command of Colonel Samuel Carroll, forded the South River, galloped into Port Republic, and created an astounding amount of havoc in a short time, capturing three staff officers and nearly taking Jackson himself, who escaped only by a mad gallop the length of the main street and over the North River Bridge. The immediate result of the assault was that Carroll's raiders suddenly found themselves in possession of that bridge. It was Jackson's worst nightmare. Carroll had only to burn the bridge, and Jackson and his army would be cut off from his supply trains and his escape routes. Fremont would have him cornered against the rampaging North River. And then something miraculous happened. Carroll, who might have changed the war and made himself a hero by burning the bridge, was actually determined to hold it. That was because his superior, Major General James Shields, had explicitly ordered him in writing to do so. It was one of the campaign's greatest tactical mistakes. And it is still not clear how Shields could have been so foolish. In keeping with his character, he was a chronic liar, Shields later blamed it all on Carroll, who by some unaccountable misapprehension had failed to burn the bridge. Shields in reality had not been able to make up his mind, and had given at least one set of conflicting orders. Though his final order was clear enough. Hold it at all hazards. Carroll did, until he and the rest of his little group, plus some infantry that had remained in the rear, were chased off by a determined Jackson, backed by two regiments and artillery. Still, why would Shields have ordered Carroll to, as Union General Nathan Kimball later put it, hold the only bridge over which Jackson could possibly escape from Fremont? The real reason may have been petty jealousy, which would also have been in keeping with Shields' deeply deficient character. According to an Ohio soldier on the previous day, Shields had said in a voice loud and rather sarcastic, "Fremont thinks he's going to raise hell up there, and I'll show him." The idea was that Fremont wanted the bridge burned to trap Jackson. Shields wanted to deny Fremont that glory. Kimball, generally a reliable source, later made the same accusation. As for Jackson's own tactical lapses, There was another reason for his sudden blindness that morning. Turner Ashby, his brilliant, erratic cavalry chief, was dead, killed in a skirmish with Union cavalry on June 6. His death underscored how dangerous life was for Civil War officers, who had a 50% greater chance of being killed than privates. Though he had failed to execute Jackson's orders at half a dozen key moments, most egregiously at Winchester, Ashby had closed out his life with a rush of redemptive glory. During Jackson's retreat south in June, he had been his old brilliant self, launching daring attacks that slowed Fremont's army, at one point even rallying straggling infantry to make a successful counterattack. For all his flaws, he was supremely brave, capable of feats of endurance in the saddle that amazed his contemporaries, and uncannily aware of where the enemy was. Such devotion to duty had taken its toll on him, as it had on Jackson. At the time of his death, he was, in the description of a contemporary, so thin he looked emaciated. With his dark skin, long dark beard, and long hair, he presented a wild sight. He told me that he'd been under fire for 60 consecutive days, but he found no inconvenience from it, wrote the soldier. In place of meals, Ashby said, I eat a few apples, drink some spring water, and draw up my sword belt a hole or two tighter, and I'm all right. It's just as good as eating. He had the blind loyalty of his men, but in his absence the cavalry quickly lost whatever meager discipline it had, and bore at least some of the blame for Carroll's freakish success that morning at Port Republic. Still, in his official report, Jackson praised Ashby, as he had never praised anyone else. The close relation which General Ashby bore to my command for most of the previous 12 months will justify me in saying that as a partisan officer, I never knew his superior. His daring was proverbial, his powers of endurance almost incredible, his tone of character heroic, and his sagacity almost intuitive in divining the purposes and movements of the enemy. But on the morning of Sunday, June 8, there was no time to mourn the fallen hero. From the north came a distant roll of artillery. Fremont's big guns were opening up on Ewell. The Battle of Cross Keys had begun. Fremont should have won the battle quickly. He had a 2-to-1 numerical advantage, and better than that in artillery. If he had thrown his entire force directly at Ewell's line, which was set up on a long ridge, he would very likely have broken it. But with Fremont, nothing was ever that simple. He was facing not just Stonewall Jackson now, but also the myth of Stonewall Jackson. And the myth told him and his officers that they were facing 20,000 battle-hardened Confederate troops, instead of the 5,000-plus effectives in front of them. At Fremont's Council of War, he and his brigade commanders worried about this terrible numerical disadvantage and bemoaned the poor condition of their ragged, starved-out, exhausted army. 150 years later, you can almost hear the defeatism. One thinks of the astonishing moral distance between their outlook and that of the dead Ashby, a man who slept little, often went hungry, and fought bravely and almost continuously without complaint. After some inconclusive skirmishing, the main battle began, as most of these battles seem to, with long-range artillery. And while cannons were very satisfying to shoot, watch, and listen to, they often did little significant tactical damage. For a cautious warrior such as Fremont, this probably seemed like a good way to fight without getting his hands dirty. George McClellan, another hesitant fighter, loved nothing better than the idea of bringing up his big guns in front of Richmond and pounding the city into submission from afar. The cannonade began at Cross Keys at 10:30 a.m., roared for 6 full hours, and consisted mostly of shooting at other batteries. An enormous amount of ordnance was used up in the process. A single Union battery shot 600 rounds that day, meaning one round per cannon every 3 minutes. In spite of this, there is little evidence that much damage was done. Another Union battery stood on the front lines for 4 hours of this shelling and lost only one man killed, one wounded. The battle on the ground, on the other hand, clearly belonged to the Confederates. It was conducted entirely by Richard Ewell, barking his profane orders in his squawky voice from his headquarters, which, unlike that of Fremont, was up on the field of battle near his artillery. Jackson, wary of the arrival of the rest of Shields' army, remained 4 miles south in Port Republic. Rebel soldiers under Brigadier General Isaac Trimble tore into the Union left, driving 3 brigades back a full mile. In the center, Brigadier General Robert Milroy, who had fought Jackson so well at McDowell and who was impatient with Fremont's passive battle management, launched a 2,000-man assault in mid-afternoon on his own initiative, only to see his men cut to pieces by Virginians in the woods. There was plenty of hard-nosed fighting on both sides, too. Men standing in the open, and loading and firing, and stepping or inching forward or backward, depending on the flow of the battle. Why a particular regiment of soldiers advanced or retreated at this and other battles in the Civil War is still something of a mystery. At bottom, fighting was about the ability to hurl enough lead at a concentrated group of soldiers so that seeing enough of their friends go down, they became convinced that they had to withdraw. Often it was just that simple. At other times, the effects of musket fire were almost imperceptible, as much the result of a soldier's belief in his chances of survival as of the actual danger he faced. Belief counted for a lot. In one's general, in the captain in front of you brandishing his gleaming sword, in the bravery of one's fellow soldiers, in the idea of winning itself. A rout might start with men taking small steps backward while reloading, then taking slightly larger steps backward while their enemy, 200 or 300 yards away, began to move very slightly forward. Soon the retreating line would begin to lose individual soldiers, then groups of them. And finally the entire line would turn and run, all without ever experiencing a single definitive moment when the battle turned. Sometimes regimental and brigade commanders simply became lost in the thick clouds of gunpowder smoke. Blinded and feeling isolated, and with the whoops and shouts of the enemy newly magnified in their ears, they might also be inclined to retreat. Though it is impossible to measure the effect of Jackson's growing reputation as a winner on his men, it was undoubtedly strong. By early evening, when Fremont ordered his troops to withdraw from their advanced positions under cover of his artillery, it was clear that Ewell had gotten the better of him. He now occupied the ground from which Fremont had launched his first attack. The final tally of casualties, 288 for the Confederates and 684 for the Federals, suggests the level of Confederate dominance. Still, Fremont's force was bloodied but not beaten. He would be able to fight the next day. Jackson, meanwhile, spent most of the day in Port Republic, fully expecting Shields to follow up on Carroll's attack. Jackson spent time placing artillery on the bluffs that overlooked the village, enough to be sure that he could stop Shields if he tried another attack across the South River. When one of his officers pointed out this possibility to him, he replied, waving his hand toward his commanding artillery positions, "No, sir. No, he cannot do it. I should tear him to pieces." The news of Ewell's victory at Cross Keys thrilled Jackson's men. They had been attacked by Fremont's full army, had struck a hard blow in return, and had driven him back. More important, as far as Jackson's staff was concerned, was the meaning of the victory. With Fremont checked and Shields not yet in evidence, they all believed that Jackson would now do the supremely logical thing, slip out under cover of darkness, take his exhausted army on the road for Brown's Gap, and call an end to the long campaign. They had underestimated their commander once again. That evening he amazed them all by ordering his quartermaster, John Harmon, to bring up the supply wagons, roll them across the North River Bridge, and give the troops rations to cook. They were going to stay and fight. Among his staff members there was a good deal of eye-rolling and looks exchanged. "The general seemed to like traps," wrote Henry Kidd Douglas, "and at any rate, was not yet satisfied with the risks he had run and the blows he had inflicted. We were getting used to this kind of aberration, but this did seem rather an extra piece of temerity." And so the huge supply train rumbled forward, campfires were lit, and likely to the astonishment of Shields and Fremont, no Confederates showed any signs of leaving Port Republic. Chapter 31. Slaughter in a Small Place. Any Union officer who was surprised by the idea that Jackson was not slipping quietly away in darkness would have been shocked to learn of his actual plans. He'd been thinking about what he would do as he paced the high ground around Fort Republic and listened to the thud of artillery from Cross Keys. He had concluded that, as he put it later, "As no movement was made by General Shields to renew the action that day, I determined to take the initiative and attack him the following morning." And that was only the first phase of an extraordinary plan, some might have called it purely crazy, to destroy both federal armies. It may or may not have been the scheme of a man who was in the middle of a physical breakdown. It was certainly, as Douglas had observed, a lot of risk, even for Jackson to take, which was saying something. The idea was to move the main body of his army, including Ewell, by night to Port Republic, cross the South River, and attack and defeat Shields' two brigades in the early morning. Then, having left a reinforced brigade under Brigadier General Isaac Trimble to hold off Fremont, Jackson would recross both the South River and the North River, march to Cross Keys, and defeat that Union army as well, this time once and for all. All before early afternoon. If anything went wrong, the cavalry was to hold the road to Brown's Gap open for escape. The plan was Beauregard-like in its wild optimism. Indeed, Jackson's staff officers were all amazed at their commander's lack of anxiety. The combative Ewell, who bridled at the timetable for marching from Cross Keys to Port Republic with his tired infantry, was nonetheless by now a full believer in his eccentric commander. Late that night he was sitting in front of his tent in conversation with new cavalry chief Tom Munford, the ranking cadet at VMI when Jackson first arrived, and one of Jackson's first acquaintances there. When the bald-pated Ewell said, in his fidgety, nervous way, "Look here, Munford, do you remember my conversation with you at Conrad's store, when I called this old man an old woman? Well, I take it all back. I will never prejudge another man. Jackson's no fool. He knows how to keep his own counsel and does curious things, but he has a method to his madness." That method was sorely tested on the morning of June 9. What was supposed to be a relatively simple task, getting the army across the South River, turned out to be a logistical nightmare. Engineers had worked through the night to build a makeshift bridge by placing wagons in the riverbed and then laying wooden planks on top of them. But the bridge was made poorly. There were gaps in the planks, and the wagons were of different heights. Soldiers began crossing in single file, and many fell off into the fast-moving, chest-high water. Many more had to wade the river in thick fog, stumbling and floating off downstream in the process. Jackson had lost his advantage almost before he started. But he was so fatigued and impatient that instead of waiting for his full five brigades, some 8,000 men in total, he marched boldly up the small river valley with only four of the Stonewall Brigade's five regiments, the Stonewall, and two batteries under the command of Charles S. Winder. Facing him were two federal brigades under Brigadier General Erastus B. Tyler, a wealthy Ohio fur merchant and one of the tougher Union fighters in the valley, and Colonel Samuel Carroll, who had made the daring raid that almost netted Jackson. Shields, who should have been with them, was stuck in Luray, 40 miles north, preparing to fight yet another ghostly apparition of General James Longstreet. Though he repeatedly assured Tyler and Carroll that "I will be with you soon," he would never show up. But his subordinates' defensive position was superb. Their right flank was anchored on the rampaging South Fork. Their left, a mile away across open wheat fields, was anchored on a lovely, elevated, mountain laurel-covered shoulder that jutted out from the foothills of the Blue Ridge. On that shoulder was a flat piece of ground where charcoal had been made, known as the coaling. The cannons that Tyler had placed there commanded the entire river plain below. By attacking with such a small force, Jackson had made a mistake. Perhaps he was still bone-weary and not thinking clearly. He had risen at 3 a.m. that day after another cruelly short night. But by failing to wait for his main force, including most of Ewell's army, he was feeding his troops into slaughter. It was not long in coming. The worst of it was at the hands of the federal gunners on the Coaling, spraying canister at rebel troops in the shelterless fields and at the base of the shoulder. The Confederates had their hands full with the Union infantry, too, which outnumbered them. Winder's men fought hard, but the replacements they desperately needed were mired for the moment in a thick tangle of wagons, men, and horses back at the South River. At about 8:30 a.m., Winder and three regiments mounted a heroic charge against twice their number, surging forward through the flat farmlands. They were soon under murderous fire. One of those regiments, the 7th Louisiana, the lead unit of Brigadier General Richard Taylor's brigade, would lose half its men. While the battle raged and the Confederate line shuddered along its length, Jackson, who now understood that just about everything was going wrong, made two critical moves. He sent orders to Isaac Trimble to abandon Cross Keys as quickly as possible, cross the North River Bridge, burn it down, and join the rest of the army east of Port Republic. Fremont, stuck on the other side of the river, would be unable to follow. Jackson, his light eyes blazing with the glow of battle, the men were beginning to call him Old Blue Light, also grabbed his mapmaker, Jed Hotchkiss, and ordered him to gather the rest of Taylor's 1,700 Louisianans who had just appeared on the field and, in his words, take that battery. By that he meant those federal guns on the Coaling that were tearing his men apart. Thus began the final drama of Stonewall Jackson's Valley campaign. Could Winder and the bloodied Stonewall Brigade hold until Taylor took out the federal guns on the Coaling? Could he take them out at all? The question was eventually settled by some of the bloodiest, most intimate fighting that these veteran soldiers had ever seen. Ewell, arriving on the main battlefield, was able to reinforce Winder enough to slow the federal advance. But the carnage in the wheat field was awful. The 31st Virginia lost 97 of its 226 officers and men. Now everything depended on Taylor's Louisianans. For them, the battle began when, upon their arrival on top of the Coaling, just as loud cheers went up from the battlefield below as the Union troops broke Winder's line, forcing it backward, federal guns unleashed a storm canister full in the faces of the Louisiana infantry, tearing great gaps in their ranks, strewing the slope behind them with the wounded and dying. The fighting soon centered on those federal batteries and their cannons, limbers, caissons, horses, artillerists, and supporting infantry. Much of the combat was brutally personal, bayonet against bayonet, clubbed musket against clubbed musket, men killing men and being covered in the blood of their enemies. Artillerymen swung their rammers, normally used to load cannons, in the absence of anything better. Horses were bayoneted and shot to keep the Union from removing its guns, and their screams joined those of the men. "It was a sickening sight," recalled one of the Louisianans. "Men in gray and blue piled up in front of and around the guns, and with the horses dying and the blood of men and beasts flowing almost in a stream." Said Taylor, "I've never seen so many dead and wounded in the same limited space." 3 times the federal batteries were seized and then lost, and soon the entire focus of the battle had shifted from the wheat field to the Coaling. The great federal counterstroke against Winder stalled. At about 10 a.m. with a final mighty surge, Taylor, reinforced now by 2 regiments under Ewell, finally took the last gun, while Winder, on the plain below him, with pieces of various regiments, swept forward. The Union line staggered, then broke, and the bluecoats turned and headed hastily back up the road they had come in on. Jackson took a moment to pray, with his head bowed and his right hand in the air, as was his custom. And then he unleashed his artillery. Deadly, bone and sinew-shredding canister from the equivalent of giant shotguns, on the receding blue column. A 4-mile chase netted 450 prisoners, 800 muskets, and a field gun. But the land soon became too thickly wooded for further pursuit. The battle was over. Somehow it was perfectly in keeping with Fremont's character that he should arrive, bayonets bristling, on the ground across the South Fork of the Shenandoah, where he could only watch helplessly as the Confederates marched their prisoners to the rear. It had escaped his notice, some hours before, that an entire Confederate division had left his front. At about 10 o'clock, he finally got up the courage to form his army in battle line and move forward, only to find that there was not a single enemy picket in sight. All he found was a church full of dead and dying men, with the now familiar pile of stacked arms and legs outside. Undaunted, Fremont marched crisply to the North River, where he discovered that the bridge had been burned. In the absence of any other obvious course of action, he mustered his impressive force on the riverbank opposite the battlefield. In the afternoon, he had advanced into the open ground near the river, recalled Confederate chaplain J. William Jones, and as I gazed on his long line of battle, his bright muskets gleaming in the rays of the sun, his battle flags rippling in the breeze, I thought it the finest military display I had ever seen. It was also entirely pointless. Fremont decided to open fire with his artillery anyway, which sent Jackson into a fury, because many of the shells fell among the casualties. Fremont, he wrote later, opened his artillery upon our ambulances and parties engaged in the humane labors of attending to our dead and wounded, and the dead and wounded of the enemy. Jackson wrote a personal note to Union Major General Irvin McDowell to complain about it. In the battle, he had suffered 800 casualties to Tyler's 1,018, disproportionately high considering he had outnumbered his opponent. Even his staunchest supporters on his staff thought his tactics that day were too impetuous. In any case, the Battle of Port Republic was over, and he had won it decisively. Usually, in the oddball logic of Stonewall Jackson's Valley Campaign, victory meant that some form of hunt and chase would begin anew. Not this time. On June 8, ironically, just as Ewell was being attacked by Fremont at Cross Keys, Lincoln and Stanton had finally decided that they had had enough of this rogue rebel general marching and countermarching in the valley and twisting their war policies into knots. Lincoln had concluded, possibly correctly, that with Jackson's skills and daring, he could probably distract Union authorities indefinitely from the real business at hand, the assault on Richmond, the end of the war. It is the object of the enemy to create alarms everywhere else and thereby divert as much of our force from that point as possible, wrote Lincoln to Stanton. On the contrary, we should stand on the defensive everywhere else and direct as much force as possible to Richmond. And so that day new orders went out recalling both Fremont and Shields, though they were not received until the next day. Shields was to join McClellan as soon as possible. Fremont was to withdraw to Harrisonburg and assume a defensive position. He was so scared that Jackson might pursue him that he went an additional 25 miles to Mount Jackson. He did not have much of a future. Less than a month later, when he was placed under the command of a former subordinate, John Pope, Fremont angrily resigned. Shields, who continued to try to blame his defeat at Port Republic on Samuel Carroll, to the increasing disgust of Shields' peers, was put on the shelf and quickly disappeared from public view. Jackson, meanwhile, was master of all he surveyed. Two Union forces were withdrawing from his front. There was a certain beautiful symmetry to it. The campaign, which started with a single enemy army pursuing Jackson southward through the valley, would end with two beaten Union armies withdrawing from him in a northerly direction. A week later, Jackson, in one of his most famous utterances, advised his mapmaker, Hotchkiss, to never take counsel of your fears. A person who followed such advice, of course, would be doomed to a short life. But at Port Republic, Jackson had indeed disregarded the fears that any sane person would have had, and produced a stunning victory in a manner that left military men in Richmond and Washington, as well as in the Shenandoah Valley, shaking their heads. His short, unadorned message to Richmond was all the more powerful for its brevity. "Through God's blessing," he wrote, "the enemy near Port Republic was this day routed with the loss of 6 pieces of his artillery." Period. He was even briefer with Anna, someone he had been neglecting of late. "God greatly blessed our arms near Port Republic yesterday and today," he wrote. Though he was aware that the Union had changed its mind about fighting in the Valley, he did not yet know that Lee and Davis had come almost simultaneously to the same conclusion. The game was in Richmond now. Richmond must be saved. Part 4, Stirrings of a Legend. Chapter 32, A Claim and a New Mission. Jackson was suddenly famous. In spite of his heroics at Manassas, he had until late May 1862 been little more than a catchy nickname operating in the back alleys of Virginia. His troubled winter march on Romney was not much of a credential, nor was his defeat at Kernstown, in spite of its grand political and military repercussions. McDowell was a small-scale dust-up on a mountain in a part of the country few had ever heard of. Jackson's victory at Winchester changed all that. His back-to-back victories over 2 Union armies 2 weeks later confirmed, if anyone needed more proof, that he hadn't just been lucky. Now, a little more than a month after his first win at McDowell, his name was pulsing through the nation's arteries as the great new military genius of the South. The agents of this transformation were largely the Virginia newspapers, whose stories were circulated and reprinted all over the Confederacy, and who, desperate for good tidings in that hopeless spring, loudly trumpeted the news. With less than 17,000 troops, and sometimes far less, Jackson had taken on and routed 52,000 troops in 3 Union armies. He had inflicted 4,600 casualties, killed, wounded, or captured, seized 9,000 small arms and a vast trove of Union supplies, and had kept more than 40,000 federal troops from joining McClellan in front of Richmond. In 5 battles and many smaller engagements from March 23 to June 9, he had marched his men 646 miles, knocked the entire Union war plan in the Eastern Theater off balance, and had done it all at a cost of 2,750 men. In the late spring of that year, he was very likely the most famous soldier in the world. The Southern press spared no adjectives in relating Jackson's victories. The Richmond Dispatch insisted that in striking blow after blow in stunning succession, Jackson's victories in the Valley rivaled Napoleon's legendary Italian campaign. In the flush of victory after Cross Keys and Port Republic, the Richmond Whig exulted, "These 2 battles are among the most brilliant, if not the most brilliant, of the war. They are the crowning glory of Jackson and his associates. Jackson and his army in 1 month have routed Milroy, annihilated Banks, discomfited Fremont, and overthrown Shields. Was there ever such a series of victories won by an inferior force by dauntless courage and consummate generalship?" While the Confederate press strutted and crowed, Northern newspapers were feasting, as usual, on spoon-fed misinformation about supposed Union victories over the upstart rebel general. After Cross Keys, a Washington abolitionist paper bragged, ridiculously, that a battle between Jackson and McDowell had resulted in the loss of General Jackson's entire command. 9,000 prisoners fell into General McDowell's hands. But even in these deeply biased accounts, there was a sense that Jackson was something different, a new nemesis to worry about and pay attention to. In the days after the humiliating Union defeat at Winchester, the New York Times had persistently painted Nathaniel Banks as one of the ablest and most useful of our chieftains because he had kept Stonewall Jackson from crossing the Maryland border. Those papers began covering their tracks soon enough, unable to avoid the stark truths of Jackson's victories. Either way, the odd, provocative name Stonewall Jackson was finding its way into the culture of the North. Several months later, a northern magazine, the American Phrenological Journal and Life Illustrated, even featured an advertisement for Pyle's OK Soap, claiming that Jackson himself used their product and liked it. "Stonewall Jackson nabs it and sighs for more," read the copy. His fame spread just as quickly through soldiers' letters, both Union and Confederate, that were often read aloud on family hearths. In the South, these were overwhelmingly adulatory. "I wish we had a whole army filled with Jacksons, and the Yankees would soon be shipped from our soil," wrote a soldier of the 11th Virginia Regiment. Wrote another from the 6th Louisiana, "Jackson is perfectly idolized by this army." Northern soldiers sent home their own praise, too, calling him a man of decided genius and this great leader who had outgeneraled all our commanders. One Union quartermaster was even court-martialed for pointing out that Stonewall Jackson had whipped the U.S. in every battle. Porter Alexander, at the time Johnston's chief of ordnance, wrote that Jackson's Valley exploits were unsurpassed in all military history for brilliancy and daring. Exactly who this new celebrity was harder to say. Though his men cheered him loudly when he rode by and boasted of his genius in letters home, they were also painfully aware of how hard they had been used and how many of their comrades, nearly a third of his force, had simply fallen away, unable or unwilling to follow. And yet, this seemingly pitiless man, with so little apparent sympathy for human suffering, was also a devout Christian. He prayed in his tent and in the woods at 3 a.m. He prayed on his horse and prayed in the midst of battle. He encouraged his men to attend religious services, distributed Christian pamphlets, and arranged for preachers to give sermons in the regimental camps. Christians especially took note that he insisted on giving God credit for his victories and even refused to read newspapers that proclaimed his own renown. This was not mere convention or pro forma humility. He genuinely feared that pride and excessive ambition would anger God and destroy the Confederacy. The manner in which the press, the army, and the people seem to lean upon certain persons is positively frightful, he told his brother-in-law D.H. Hill, referring to himself. They are forgetting God in the instruments he has chosen. It fills me with alarm. He wrote his Lexington pastor, the Reverend William S. White, asking him to warn his congregation that if we fail to trust in God and give him all the glory, our cause is ruined. In all this, he seemed to many to be the epitome of the selfless leader, a commodity in short supply in both armies. No thought of personal advancement, of ambition or applause, wrote Robert Louis Dabney, his chief of staff at the time, ever for one instant divided the homage of his heart with his great cause. Perhaps no commander in the war was quite as isolated from common humanity as Jackson was. Command is lonely anyway. Jackson's policy of sharing little or no important information with his officer corps made it doubly so. He held no councils of war, consulted no one about strategy or tactics. Unlike most generals in the war, he did not even ask for casual advice from peers or subordinates. This isolation was almost certainly made worse by the absence of any emotional leavening in his life. There was no Laura, Ellie, Maggie, or Anna to whom he could spill out his heart behind the safety of closed doors. The loving, affectionate, domestic side of his dual personality had temporarily disappeared. Though he never admitted it, even in letters to Anna, he must have been terribly lonely. The most human part of him, and the most surprising to his men, was his exceptional kindness, something that everyone who knew him well, from West Point forward, inevitably commented on. It was perhaps the least understandable of all of his unusual personality traits. It did not seem to fit with the rest of him. In spite of the crushing demands of his job, he sat for hours with his surgeon, Hunter McGuire, to comfort him after a family tragedy, which prompted McGuire to write later of his great kindness, his tenderness to those in trouble or affliction. Brigadier General William B. Tolliver, one of the leaders of the revolt against Jackson after Romney, and a man Jackson disliked, who was recuperating from an illness in the valley, wrote that Jackson insisted that I should rest myself upon his bed. and as he assured me that he had no immediate expectation of collision with the enemy, I consented, and he carefully, with his own hands, threw his blanket over me. I mention this incident to show the genuine kindness of his nature. All of this was part of his growing notoriety, too, a notoriety that, as it lodged itself in the thinking of the Union command, would have everything to do with what happened next in the Virginia theater of the Civil War. While people in the North and South sought to calibrate the man and to discover what he was made of, the fundamental truth of him was still his string of stunning victories in the Valley campaign. It was so transformative that it naturally inspired jealousy, both then and later, the gist of which was, as Longstreet was the first to say publicly after the war, that Jackson's accomplishment had come against less than excellent Union generals. No one would argue the central point. Banks, Shields, and Fremont were in many ways typical of the early war generals on both sides, who did not fight especially well and were soon weeded out. Jackson took what they gave him and ruthlessly exploited their weaknesses. The same could be said for the wartime career of Ulysses S. Grant, who in the first 2 years of the war operated in a similarly chaotic environment against inferior opponents. At Fort Donelson, where he insisted on unconditional surrender, which made him famous, he was up against Gideon J. Pillow, one of the worst generals in the war. Lesser generals were the rule, not the exception, in the early part of the war, and the great generals made their names against inferior opposition because that was the only opposition that existed. Such arguments, moreover, missed the fact that Jackson and Grant were both among the great early innovators of the war, for whom the quality of the opposing commanders was merely one of many problems they faced and solved. Both were doing things without precedent in military history, executing marches and military maneuvers and transporting troops and building supply lines in ways that were quite new. While Jackson was leading his army through the last phase of the Valley campaign, an event of singular and momentous importance had taken place in Richmond. The event was not, as one might have expected, the wounding on June 1 of Major General Joseph E. Johnston at the Battle of Seven Pines, a bloody 11,000 casualty stalemate fought after Johnston had attacked McClellan's left wing east of Richmond. Though that might have been a crippling blow to a Confederacy already short of competent generals, it turned out to be a wonderful piece of good fortune. The transformative event was an order, issued by Confederate President Jefferson Davis at 1:30 p.m. on June 1, appointing Robert E. Lee to replace Johnston as commander of the Army of Northern Virginia. This was by no means an obvious move. Lee, while widely respected, had not performed well in his only prior field command in Western Virginia in 1861, and had spent the war in a desk job as Davis's military advisor. Many generals in that army did not believe he was equal to the work. A bit too fussy was the feeling. Now Davis was entrusting him with the fate of Richmond, and by extension, the South. Though no one suspected it at the time, Davis had made what was probably the single most important decision of the war, on either side. But from the moment he took the job, Lee was in an unsustainable position. He had quite possibly taken the worst job in the world. He was outnumbered by McClellan almost 2-1. In a pitched battle in front of Richmond, he would stand little chance of surviving. In a siege, favored by Little Mac, he stood no chance at all. A federal assault, meanwhile, could happen at any moment. This meant that he needed every soldier he could get his hands on, which meant that he needed Jackson, and he needed him now. One of Lee's first moves was to send his Valley subordinate 3 brigades of 8,000 troops so that he could crush whatever remained of federal resistance in the Valley and then join the army in front of Richmond. But Lee soon thought better of it and summoned his newly reinforced Valley commander directly to Richmond. Jackson would have preferred to take 40,000 men and burn Philadelphia and Baltimore to the ground, thereby forcing McClellan from Richmond. While Lee would soon come around to his way of thinking, it was too late for that now. Jackson threw out a wide cavalry screen to block all awareness of Confederate preparations and movements, then launched 18,500 men and their supply trains over and through the Blue Ridge Mountains. Since he could only lay hands on 200 train cars, His wagons, cavalry, and artillery all went by roads, while the infantry marched and rode the rails by turns in a hopscotching system of Jackson's own design. It was this large-scale, highly secret troop movement east to join Lee that Confederate Congressman Alexander Boteler had observed on that railroad platform in Charlottesville on June 19. Jackson, with his fame ringing through the South and his legend in full ascent, was going east to join Lee and save Richmond. With that city's fate hanging in the balance, Jackson's turn from the valley was one of the most thrilling moments of the war. "We are on the eve of stirring times," wrote Jackson's quartermaster John Harmon, a feeling shared by many of the men in that army. For Jackson, an entirely new war began at an hour past midnight on June 23. That was when he left Frederick's Hall near Charlottesville on horseback, bound for a meeting of generals at Lee's headquarters east of Richmond. Jackson traveled as an ordinary subaltern. He carried only a pass for one officer and was accompanied by two soldiers and a guide. Using relays of commandeered horses, he rode 52 miles in 14 hours. When he arrived at a large two-story mansion a few miles northeast of the Richmond city limits, he was told that Lee was working. Unwilling to disturb the senior officer, Jackson walked back into the yard to wait. A few minutes later, Major General D.H. Hill rode up and was startled to discover his brother-in-law Tom, dusty and tired-looking, leaning against a fence. In spite of his frail physique and sometimes sarcastic tongue, Hill was a first-class fighter. He was almost as religious as Jackson. The two men were greeting each other warmly when Lee's aide beckoned them. Inside the house, they found Lee and two other major generals, James Longstreet and Ambrose Powell A.P. Hill. Longstreet was a strapping 6'2" with broad shoulders, a broad face, and a heavy beard. Everything about him was broad and blunt. He had graduated from West Point 3 years before Jackson. He was bright, self-important, and opinionated. He was also fearless, imperturbable on the battlefield, a dependable if unspectacular fighter who had burnished his reputation at the Battle of Seven Pines. He favored defensive fighting, a position that put him considerably in advance of the thinking of most military men of the moment. Lee trusted him. He'd been born in South Carolina but grew up mostly in Georgia. He'd spent his military career in a string of dusty outposts, mostly as paymaster. The loss of three children in an epidemic was said to have robbed him of his humor. Jackson knew him from Manassas. Little Powell Hill had been in Jackson's West Point class, where, along with other members of the Virginia aristocracy, he had made fun of the orphan from the Western Mountains. He was proud, sensitive, and thin-skinned, and had a hair-trigger temper. He would prove to be one of the South's best fighters. His graduation from West Point had been delayed because of the venereal disease he had contracted, a sickness that helped spoil his chances to marry the lovely Ellen Marcy, who instead chose Powell's close friend, George B. McClellan. All four Confederate generals had been at West Point at the same time. Then there was Lee himself, the soldier's soldier with 3 decades of spotless military service. He'd been born in 1807, the son of Henry Light Horse Harry Lee, a hero of the Revolutionary War. He had graduated second in his class at West Point and distinguished himself in the Mexican-American War, where his daring exploits as a scout and engineer were crucial in enabling Winfield Scott to break enemy defenses in 3 major American victories. He was the quintessential Virginia aristocrat. He lived in a Greek Revival mansion that was one of the largest homes in antebellum Virginia, and was married to the daughter of George Washington's step-grandson, whom George and Martha Washington had raised as a son. Tall, handsome, and a bit heavy-set, with a full gray beard and a head of gray hair, Lee was so gentle and polite, calm and stately, that it was difficult to see the fighter in him. Though, in fact, he had a far more pure strain of military character than even Jackson himself. Jackson's interests ranged to literature, poetry. Lee devoted no time to literature and did almost no general reading. His interests, beyond his family and his religion, were few, and even though he was quite devout, Even here he lacked Jackson's taste for more complex theology. The Bible was sufficient. Unlike Jackson, he had by hard study and a career in the service made himself highly proficient in tactics, logistics, and engineering, those military sciences he knew as well as anyone. Just at that moment, Jackson was by far the more famous of the two.